Good afternoon and welcome to our special Main Street broadcast from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Rush City. I'm Rachel Reedy. For the 6,000 men and women in Minnesota prisons, the goal is serving their sentences and getting out. But for many ex-convicts, returning to the community is not easy. It's especially difficult for sex offenders, who are among the most feared people in society. Every year, some 450 sex offenders are released from custody in Minnesota. About 20% of those will be arrested for another sex crime. While cities provide some measure of anonymity, half of Minnesota sex offenders live in small town Minnesota, where everybody knows your name and where you went and why. Main Street Radio's Leifanger reports.
Jerry, we'll call him Jerry, lives with his fiance in a rented two-story house in a town of 500 in central Minnesota. He's lived in the area most of his life. Of several dozen sex offenders approached for interviews, Jerry is the only one who agreed to tell his story. It starts with a broken home, an abusive family, and an incident with a firearm, about which this is all Jerry will say.
I was in a compromising situation. I ended up shooting and killing my sister, who was younger than I, my half-sister. That happened when I was 8. I guess that's pretty much when it all started.
The shooting happened when Jerry was living in Alaska with his father. Too young to be charged with a criminal offense, he spent a year under study in a psychiatric ward, was returned to Minnesota, and spent time in a home for troubled youth. At 11, he was released to his family. He started smoking pot. He became a chronic runaway and thief. At 18, he was a convicted check forger and self-described sex addict. At 21, he was jailed for third-degree criminal sexual conduct after assaulting an underage girl.
Some people have crutches. You know, some people are alcoholics. Some people are addicted to chemicals. I was then addicted to sex. I had to have sex whenever, wherever. I sat 6 months for that, I believe. I was just then beginning to realize some of the things that I had done to people around me. I didn't have a direction, nor did I have enough forethought to see a direction. I just knew that I'd done wrong.
Jerry says he's lucky to have spent time in the county jail rather than state prison. Those coming out of the prison system are classified as low, moderate, or high risks to reoffend. High-risk releases are publicized with flyers and press notices. But while Jerry's release was low profile, this is a small town. You don't need flyers to be famous. This former neighbor isn't giving Jerry the benefit of the doubt.
I come home, I believe from work it was. My wife was complaining about the neighbor guy. When she was sunbathing, he was looking out the window, him and his roommate, with binoculars at her. It was scary, you know.
And if you ran into him today?
I wouldn't tell him where I live. I don't want to find out if he's better.
In the stale basement of the county courthouse, probation officer Pat Shorn presides over the files of some 90 clients, including 15 sex offenders. Shorn is stocky, with a heavy handshake and the shoulders of a wrestling coach. If Jerry starts avoiding Shorn, or skipping work, or the weekly mandatory group therapy sessions, Shorn tracks him down and works on his attitude.
Can be anger, could be a deviant fantasy or something. We try to teach them each step of the way along that they can get off that wheel and get on the good side and say, no, I'm not going to do this. That even though they've got it planned and maybe right outside the house or wherever they're going to do, they can still say, no, this isn't for me.
Shorn's been involved with Jerry 10 years, since he was a 15-year-old runaway. In 1998, Jerry started missing meetings, then abruptly left the state without the required travel permit. When he returned, Shorn discovered Jerry had performed a breathtaking dive off the wagon, sexually assaulting his previous victim, who was still underage, stealing and drug dealing. Back to jail he went.
My biggest mistake was saying, well, I'll never do this again. You know, you say you're never going to do it, but you can't predict the future. You know, you never know what kind of situation you're going to be in tomorrow, and you never know how you'll handle it. I don't know, I guess if I believe that there's always a chance that it could happen again, then I keep my guard up, watching out for situations that I shouldn't be in.
Jerry got out just 10 months ago. This time he hopes his focus on work and his young family will help keep him right side up. His fiance, whom we'll call Lori, just had their first child. She had two previously while living with Jerry's older brother. Seeming older than her 25 years, Lori admits her relationship with Jerry has been expensive.
My dad disowned me. I don't associate with him. That bothers me. Yeah, that hurts. But that's how they are, people. Oh, well. My mother, she got over it, I guess.
Asked if she'd do anything differently, Lori first says maybe, then no.
A lot of people will say, don't you worry? Aren't you scared? No, I'm not. Not one bit, or I wouldn't be here.
At a nearby poultry farm, Jerry and his work partner, Dave, lay up sheets of white steel siding, giving a new look to an aging turkey barn.
Put something behind here, Jerry, to kind of cover this.
After his release, Jerry says, his record made it hard to find work. He had some construction background, as did Dave, who he met in jail. The two are doing freelance work, taking a job at a time, hoping it turns into a career. Jerry and Dave.
I mean, it'd be nice to get this one done and use it as a reference, you know, get some people to see it. And I mean, this is the first one we've done this size. It looks like a month's going to be pretty tight.
He likes to shut it out every now and then a little early.
He's threatening to make me work a Saturday.
Jerry says he's set these goals for the next 10 years. He wants to marry Lori and buy a house with her. He wants to build a respected and prosperous business. And he wants to explain his past to his kids before it gets explained to them by someone else.
I look back and say, yeah, if this and if that, but you know what they say, if ifs and buts were bolts and nuts. They're not. You know, it did happen. I don't think I'll ever be able to earn back the trust and respect of everyone. There's always going to be people that are going to think that that was a bad thing. Regardless of what you're doing today, that's what you did then. There'll always be people that won't be able to get over that.
For his neighbors who want to get over it, Jerry says his door is open. Especially in small towns, he believes, a sex offender's best chance at a normal life is a transparent life. Leif Enger, Minnesota Public Radio.
I'm Rachel Reby, and this Main Street Special is coming to you live from the library at the Rush City Prison. Our guests this afternoon are Dan Kane, president of RS Eden, a program providing correctional and substance abuse services, Mark Carey, deputy commissioner for the Department of Corrections, and Donna Waltering, Reconnect program director for Amicus, a private nonprofit program which helps offenders return to the community. Good afternoon and welcome to all of you. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your calls and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, call us at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. This prison an hour north of the Twin Cities boasts all the latest innovations in design and technology. With its 825 locked doors and 325 digital video cameras, there's a 12-foot high fence laced with razor wire running a mile around the perimeter. And yet every one of the 951 men that will eventually be locked up here will get out of prison and return to live among us. Does that scare us as a society? Donna, you think so?
Oh, very much. Society does not know how to even think or consider people coming back from after having committed a major crime. They don't understand what's coming toward them. The community isn't there ready to support the ex-offender. They're afraid. They don't know how to cope.
And are we afraid because of our ignorance? Do we not see them as one of us?
Oh, absolutely not. They've been ostracized for centuries, generations, however far back you want to go. Those who have broken the law are considered to be other than me, separate from I. And so therefore we turn the other way and we don't look forward to caring for these people that are going to come back into our own communities. This is the major problem the returning offender, or at that time ex-offender, has. When he returns to his community, no one there will help. Seldom does he have support. If his family supports him, often they're ostracized by others who don't understand. And so it's a huge, huge hurdle.
And yet we're so big on protecting individuals' rights. Does that mean everybody except ex-convicts, Dan?
Well, I think that we have limited the opportunities for ex-convicts to reintegrate into society, and in terms of rights, there are ways to get around the issue of rights. Probably the most difficult thing for people to do when they get out, three things. One is to find housing, two is to find adequate employment, and three is to find a social group that will accept you and that you feel comfortable fitting into, that isn't antisocial, the kind of group that you're involved with for most people when they went to prison. And we have inhibitions in people's ability to do that that aren't necessarily a denial of rights, but they're just the same. For instance, with a 1% vacancy rate in housing, no one needs to rent to an ex-offender. An ex-offender can come in with 6 months worth of rent, and there's still a risk, whereas someone who has never been an ex-offender may be less of a risk. So it winds up that the person that will rent to the ex-offender may well be the same person who rents to the crack dealer, and it presents a lot of difficulty. The same thing holds true with jobs. We've gotten much more adept at tracking people electronically so that everyone knows their business, and consequently most jobs involve background checks, criminal background checks, and people are limited. And our legislature has gone so far as to increase the residual effects of criminal convictions by limiting jobs through law. I mean, there are certain jobs, for instance, that an ex-offender cannot get today that he could get 2 or 3 years ago. So yes, we've reduced their rights, if you want to call them rights.
And Mark Carey, have we done that because the public demands that? We want to be protected. We want to at least feel safe.
I think what's happened is there's been an increased desire on the public's part to be more aware of what's happening. And so as a result of that, you see more and more opportunities being opened up to share with the public information that they need in order to help protect themselves. Certainly in the area of sex offenders, we've gone a great distance in this regard. What we're trying to do is balance the public's definite right to know and to protect themselves and the offender's right, if you will, to successfully integrate back into the community, and that's a very delicate balance.
Last month, a 22-year-old man who sexually assaulted two young girls in Swift County was released from prison. The community corrections people in the county have been scrambling to find him a place to live and work. We have 6W program director Steve Ullman on the phone with us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Rachel. How are you?
I'm fine. How tough is it then to find a place for this guy?
Well, it's been quite an experience. We had a placement arranged in a small community in Swift County, which was the county of commitment. And after this was arranged, the community notification information was sent to the local law enforcement people as per policy. And local law enforcement, again, as per the policy, posted this information in the community as required. Everything was going smooth to this point. Then the community reacted with alarm at the possibility of a level 3 sex offender who was unknown to them being released to their town. And they put so much pressure on the landlord that he withdrew his offer of a rental unit for the offender the very day before he was scheduled to be released from prison.
Now, Steve, you made the point that this level 3 sex offender was not known to them. Are you saying that if he'd graduated from that high school that they would have said, okay, you're one of ours, come back? Is it easier to place them when they grow up there?
It may have been. It
but
may have been easier, yes. Uh-huh.
But in this case, they had no reason to want this man.
Right. They knew nothing about this person other than what was included in the community notification information.
So you had one possibility. As soon as the community notification information went out, that person got pressure and he backed out in his agreement to rent this person a place. So then what do you do?
Well, the release date is certain from the Department of Corrections. So the individual still, the offender, was still released the next day on schedule. And fortunately, at the 11th hour, we were able to arrange a temporary placement at 180 Degrees, which is a halfway house in Minneapolis. They agreed to take the offender for up to 10 days, and we really appreciate them doing that because If not, we had absolutely no release plan for this individual. And since then, he has moved to another temporary halfway house in the metropolitan area, but he still has no permanent residence.
Steve, how many hours has your department spent? How many places have you contacted trying to find a place for this man to live?
I talked to the, have been spending a lot of time with the agent assigned to this case, and we estimate probably about 60 hours of his work time and overtime has been going to transport this offender to possible placements and supervising him since he's been released.
And you cannot find a place, but you're still looking.
Yes, we cannot find a place. He's on hold. We have a reprieve now up until the latter part of May. But ultimately, this individual is going to have to have a place to live.
Why is he going back to Swift County if he did not grow up there, and his only connection with the county is the fact that he sexually assaulted two young girls there?
This is a policy, as I understand it, of the Department of Corrections at this time and the prison system, that when an individual is sentenced from a given county for a given offense, whether he resides there or not, at the time that the individual comes due for release from prison, he will go back to that county of commitment for placement, whether he has any place to live there or not. So that's how Swift County was tapped.
Mark Carey, let's talk about this. Is that the Department of Corrections policy that you return to where you to the scene of the crime, so to speak?
Yes.
The policy really is it's directed at public safety. We have, if you will, a series of decisions that have to be made. The first one is, can this individual go back to the place where they have some residence, some permanent residence? Do they have relatives? Do they have a spouse? Do they have some roots in that particular community? Because we know very well that offenders are much more likely to succeed when they can get reconnected to a pro-social group of people, and if they have family members and clergy and others that they already have a relationship with, that is our first priority. However, many offenders don't have those circumstances. Either their family moved away, or if they committed an offense with a child, it could be that their family members are in a home, or relatives are in a home with young children, so we can't place that child or that offender there. Then we look at, does the offender have a place to stay? Because as Steve is pointing out, it is very difficult for these people to find housing.
And you can't start looking for jobs until they have a place to live.
That's
obviously.
Right. So our second tier of decision-making, you will, is a housing one. When you get down to the bottom of the list, the bottom line, you can't find a place where they have relatives, where they have roots, where they don't have employment or housing, we've got to go to the last resort, and the last resort is the county of commit. And that's what happened in this particular case. And if I can make just a quick comment on a previous statement, it's anonymity that makes this so difficult. We know that we are afraid of that which we do not know, which we do not understand. If you're a family member of an offender, they're not afraid, typically, of that offender coming out. If you grew up in a community where you have connections with that community, they're not so afraid of that person coming back. It's when the individual is anonymous that the community grows fearful, understandably so, and there are many, many instances where we've partnered with the community, had them meet the offender, engaged in a dialogue with that offender, and you'll see that fear begin to dissipate.
Donna Waltering, do you agree with that, that when we don't know a person, that they suddenly have horns, they have a tail, they're not in the same race that we are?
Absolutely, but I also disagree a bit with Mark by saying that when we do know him also or her, there's also fear there. There's the unknown, the feeling that we don't know what's going to happen to the person that we know. Why did they do the crime to begin with? He's always been a good kid. She's always done well. Yes, the unknown is a great fear because this is a horned person.
but also the known is too. It's just a general feeling of all of us being just a little afraid.
So we're not really all that anxious to bridge the chasm. We don't really want to get to know that person.
Not in my backyard.
We've been talking to Steve Ullman, Program Director for 6W Community Corrections in West Central Minnesota. Steve, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure, Rachel.
Thanks. You're listening to a special Main Street Radio program from Minnesota's newest prison at Rush City. I'm Rachel Reeby. We're discussing the challenges inmates face when they leave prison. Our guests, Donna Waltering from Amicus, Dan Kane, President of RS Eden, and Mark Carey, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. We'll be back with more of Main Street after news and weather.
This summer, Garrison Keillor and the cast from A Prairie Home Companion are back at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul for three live broadcasts and a special broadcast from the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. NPR members, order your tickets now before they go on sale to the general public next week. Garrison's guests include jazz singer Banu Gibson, traditional Irish group Dervish, and, of course, Rich Dworsky and the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, and more. Call Ticketmaster at 612-673-0404 or stop by the Fitzgerald box office and get your member discount.
Good afternoon. It's 1228 with news headlines from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Greta Cunningham. Miami's police chief has quit his job because he says he can't continue to serve under someone who's trying to divide the city over the Ilian Gonzalez case. Yesterday, the mayor fired the city manager who had refused the mayor's demand that he fire the police chief. The mayor was angered that Police Chief O'Brien didn't tell him ahead of time that there was going to be a raid. Dozens of Miami residents have alleged police brutality following Saturday's pre-dawn raid. After the stock market closes today, the government is going to be asking a federal judge to split Microsoft into two competing companies. The suggestion will be that the companies not be allowed to reunite for at least 10 years. It's the outcome the Justice Department wants to see after its successful antitrust lawsuit. Rudolph Giuliani is thanking New Yorkers today for their get-well wishes. He says it shows that the people of his city aren't as tough and cynical as they seem. The mayor announced yesterday that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer and that it may cause him to abandon his New York Senate bid. NASA officials say it'll be mid-May at the earliest before the space shuttle Atlantis can take off to fix the International Space Station. This week, three scheduled liftoffs were scrubbed due to weather conditions. The next attempt, according to NASA, will be May 18th. In regional news, the State Department of Transportation is observing Workers' Memorial Day today, honoring workers who have been injured or killed while building or maintaining Minnesota's highways. A MnDOT spokesperson says 19 workers have been killed on the job since 1960. MnDOT employees will observe a moment of silence to honor those workers at 2 this afternoon. This year's commemoration also includes the unveiling of a permanent transportation workers' monument at the department's main headquarters near the state capitol in St. Paul. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for sunshine in the west with some clouds in the east. High temperatures today ranging from 58 to 68 degrees. Clear skies statewide tonight with lows from 35 to 45 degrees. And for Saturday, sunshine statewide with high temperatures near 65 to 75 degrees. Right now in the Twin Cities, report of sunshine, a temperature of 60 degrees. That's a check on the latest news.
Welcome back to this Main Street special on Life After Prison. I'm Rachel Reeby. We're broadcasting from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Rush City. Our guests this afternoon are Mark Carey, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, Donna Waltering, Reconnect Program Director for Amicus, and Dan Kane, President of RS Eden. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. If you are outside the metropolitan area, call us at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you are in the Twin Cities, you can call us at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We go to the phones now where Laura is standing by in St. Paul. Good afternoon, Laura. Welcome to Main Street.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to both discussions and would like to try and tie in the two. I'm bothered by the continuous focus by both politicians and community on the money expenditure for inmates. I understand the concern, but I'd also like to comment that we might be spending that much, but Minnesota also has the highest educated inmates once they get out of the prison system compared to all other states. I think that society bears a certain amount of responsibility once inmates are released. If we're not spending any time or energy to educate them or give them skills to stay away from the activities that they were committing that got them into prison once they're out, I think that we need to be more proactive and more preventative in our communities and our policing in order to get the prison population down. And I also wanted to comment on the concern of racial population within the state of Minnesota, and let just make a comment that a lot of, or a good portion of inmates are being sent to us from other states because of our system. And that's all. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Reaction, comments, Mark Carey?
Yeah, if I could, on the first point, I appreciate the caller's perspective on this. When I talk to community groups, I try to explain that this is really a partnership between the government officials and the community. And what I like to encourage the community to think about is this, that they have really four responsibilities when it comes to crime. First and foremost, they have a responsibility to support the victim. That when a crime occurs, they really have a responsibility to reach out to that victim and help that individual. Secondly, they have a responsibility to offer an opportunity for the offender to reintegrate back into the community. That's not something that can be delegated. That's something that the community really has to take a role in. Thirdly, the community has to give messages of what behavior is acceptable and what's not. And lastly, they need to address some of the causes of crime. What that requires then is a partnership, if you will, between government and the community around information, around expectations, around bringing our resources to bear to help deal with the total crime picture.
We have Andy from Woodbury on the phone. Good afternoon, Andy. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Minnesota's prison system is probably about as safe and as humane and progressive as you can get. However, where the state sorely lacks is after-offender help, adjustment, and employment. There's a social clearinghouse that's needed in the Twin Cities where inmates without telephones can go and look at the paper in the morning, fill out a job application, put down a phone number. If 3M wants to hire you, they're not going to go to your flop house looking for you because you don't have a telephone. Application, realistic job expectations, counselors to say, hey, maybe you're not trained for this job. Maybe you have to start off the car wash. We need those kind of things. We need referrals to other agencies. You lock people up, they commit a crime, they deserve to be locked up. The community is not going to help. They don't want a prison in their backyard. They don't want an ex-convict in their backyard. But I think we need to get the state to spend a little money for a clearinghouse in St. Paul. I think we need to look at corporations or foundations for some grants, for some money to follow these people up. Going out of prison with $100 and two sets of clothes and no job, you're probably going to get a gun the next morning. You're being set up for failure.
Dan Kane, do you agree?
Well, I think I touched a little bit earlier about the difficulty with jobs and housing, but probably the thing that illustrates what the gentleman talked about more than anything else is the fact that we've tripled the size of our prison population in the past 25 years, and we have not added one, and that's correct, not one adult community corrections bed in that same time. And if we're going to hope that people are going to integrate back into our society, we have to give them the opportunity to do that.
You're talking about halfway houses, Dan?
I'm talking about community corrections programs, halfway houses, community programs. We have not added one adult bed.
We are broadcasting from the library at the Rush City Prison. We have an audience of staff members and some prison inmates in with us this afternoon. Leif Anger is standing with them. Leif?
I've been talking with Dalbert Griffin, with Clinton Strother, and Kenneth Crew, who are three inmates here. And all three are in on parole violations. They have been out before, they're back in. They've all been in the position of looking for a job and being asked on the application if they've committed felonies. And I guess I'd like to ask you guys what you do in that situation. What do you have to do? Clinton Strother?
You have to lie. If you put on an application that you committed a felony or that you're a convicted felon, they're not going to hire you because the job market, even though there are a lot of jobs out there, they're going to take a person that's less qualified than you are, that doesn't have a felony, as opposed to taking a person that is qualified that has a felony. Personally, I have a college degree, and when I go out looking for a job, I have to change. First of all, you have to pad your resume to make up for the time that you've been in prison, because you can't say, well, I haven't been working for 8 months because I've been on sabbatical. It doesn't work. So you have to pad it, and you have to fill in the gap. And then you have to change a few numbers. You have to change some things because the way that they track you now, they have electronic tracking is really good, and they figure it out, especially the big companies. They will spend a lot of money to track your background, and once they find out that you've lied, then they fire you. So you'll get about 3 or 4 months of good work in, and then you'll get terminated. And that's when you say, well, maybe going out and committing this crime wasn't so bad, because at least I'm able to put food on the table. See, what a lot of people don't understand about us is that we have families too. We have people that we have to support also. And if we can't do it on the legitimate way, then we're going to do it the only way we know how.
Kenneth Crewe, what's your experience been like? I know that you've got a family waiting at home. You're getting out in July. What'll you do?
I'll basically go back to trying to get good jobs, but I'll start off where I did before at McDonald's or White Castles or somewhere small. I'll have to take what I can get, basically. I might, like last time I had to work for 8 months at McDonald's, and it looks better if you got a job and you're trying to get something better. If a person looks on your resume and say, well, he's already employed, he's been working there for a while, you stand a better chance of getting a better job, a higher paying job. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you get frustrated working at fast food restaurants, you know. You're an older person, you're in there around younger guys, you know, it's really hard.
You're mentioning that it's easier than a person would think to violate parole and end up right back here.
Yeah, it's real easy to violate parole. You know, I used to thought that parole consisted of repeating the crime that you did or something related to that. It could be a dirty UA, dirty breathalyzer, failure to inform agent of your change in movement. If you change houses or if you change jobs, you can get violated for that, sent back.
What is it like, apart from work, to go back to your home community and back to your home? How do you reconnect with people? Is that difficult?
It's very difficult. It was very difficult for me. I mean, I even tried an interstate compact. My family...
Explain what that is.
Interstate compact is when you change states, but your jurisdiction stays in Minnesota. You know, you can go to another state and live. I have family in Nebraska. My children are in Nebraska, and I've been away from them since 1989. And when I went back in 1997 to 98 and tried to relocate, you know, try to get back with my family, they didn't accept me. My family wouldn't accept me. My oldest son said, well, I've been the man of the house for this long. Why should I accept you, you know, as man of the house now? And it became what they consider a domestic in Nebraska. And the fact that I came in contact with the police department violated my parole, and they brought me back to Minnesota.
Difficult for you also, Clinton Strother, going back to your family.
Yes, it's difficult to reconnect with your significant other because things change. When you're in the penitentiary and you're away from your family, life goes on outside the penitentiary. And you have to, when we're in here, life stops, okay? Even though the world continues, goes in and out, day after day after day, for us in here, life stops. And the only thing we look forward to is our out date. And when we step back out there, we think that things are the way they were the day we left. But it's not like that. You know, kids have grown up. Emotions have changed. Housing situations have changed. And so then we have to find ourselves in a position where we have to reconnect with them. Because we're catching up. We've stopped, they've moved on. And it's hard to keep a relationship together when you're in here. It's real hard, it's real stressful. And you can't, and then we have to find ways to vent that while we're in here. Half of the reason we have conflict in here is not because of things that go on in here, it's things that go on outside on the street that we have no control of, and that causes conflict within here.
We've been hearing about the importance of a structure to support you when you get out. One thing you mentioned, Kenneth Crewe, is that your affiliation with corrections is over this July, and that's going to change the way that that you're able to get help, for example, when you get out.
Yeah, for instance, I'll be off parole when I get out. So my dealings with Department of Correction is over now. I can't go up to the Department of Corrections and say, well, I need this help to do this. They're no longer connected with me. They'll tell me that, well, you have to find that help on your own. Whereas if a person's still on parole when he gets out, he can go to his parole officer, and he'll lead him into the right direction to talk to. They have certain things set up to where they can help you get some clothes and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I mean, maybe it'll help you try to find in the right direction to get a job. But once you're off parole and you leave out of here, you're on your own.
Kenneth, Clinton, Delbert, thanks very much.
Donna Waltering, you had quite a reaction when the inmate said you have to lie to get a job. I'm assuming that runs contrary to what you tell the inmates when you're meeting with them.
Yes, it certainly does. No matter what happens, if you don't tell the truth, you're going to get caught. If you don't tell the truth, you wound up in prison. If you don't tell the truth, you'll lose a job. We're all rejected at one time or another. I've lost jobs because I've been fired, or I have been rejected from a job that I wanted because they didn't like whatever it was about me. Telling the truth, having an opportunity to be able to say, I have been in prison on applications where it asks if you've been convicted, I always tell them to mark yes and will explain. And then at interview, they have an opportunity to say what they did, how they feel about what they did, what they've learned while they've been in prison, and many of them have gone through lots of programs, anger management and critical thinking. They have had an opportunity to change their lives, and they can tell an employer this. Yes, they may get rejected. All background checks are going to come back, and they're going to show that they have had a felony record. Yes, there is a hole in their employment history. But why not get out there in front and say, yes, I did this, and I need an opportunity now to change my life. I have a family I want to support. I want to live normally. I want to be able to have a job where I can earn vacation time and earn sick leave.
Will they eventually get hired, Donna?
Oh, sure.
They will eventually get hired.
It's very good right now because there's a lot of jobs that are wanting. Now, it's true, higher educated people with better job skills have to go perhaps lower in employment than they would like to go. But all they need to do is an established work history.
Clinton, is that the problem with you? You don't want to take a job beneath your college degree level? Are you saying you can't get any job when you're honest?
No, the problem that comes up is I understand what she's saying. But the problem that comes up is that after you can only take rejection so long. I mean, you still have to put food on the table. You still have that rent to pay. I mean, the organizations that are out there to help you, they will help you with your first month's rent, and they will help you with your deposit. But they will only do that after you have a job.
Yet your colleague is standing up there saying he worked at McDonald's, he's worked at White Castle. Would you do that, or do you just think, I'm not doing that?
Well, yeah, I'll do it. I mean, I've had to do it, but I'd rather not.
Dan Kane, has life gotten so much more difficult since you got out of prison? So much more difficult? Or was it still hard to get a job?
Well, I think it's gotten more limiting. I think as we've moved forward in the information age, the ability to track people has become much more prevalent amongst businesses and people, and I think that in large part we're more fearful of crime than we were in the past and people who committed crimes. On the other hand, I know that Donna, in some ways there are those that would consider that there's an element of naivete in saying that it pays to tell the truth more than accept the consequences of perhaps not telling the truth. And that's one lesson that I am very grateful that I lived long enough to learn. There are consequences for telling the truth sometimes, but very rarely are they as severe as the consequences of not telling the truth. We found the ability to, and again, with some of the people that we work with, we're the advocate for them, but we've gone to businesses and we've said, you know, we have a situation here with someone who, if they walked through your front door, filled out an application, gave you a resume, and told the truth, you probably wouldn't hire them. But we want you to take a risk on them for a couple reasons. One, you need employees. It's a tight economy, a tight job market. Number two, if they make it, they are entirely likely to be a very grateful and a very loyal employee because they need a chance and you gave it to them. Number three, they have skills. They're able to think on their feet. You can't be a criminal for very long without having a quick wit and the ability to make very quick decisions. Number four, we will tag team with you to create a safety net, if you will, for this person who, if you speak, I mean, if he has problems at work, you talk to us via privileged communication. If he has a problem at home, we'll talk to you. And if we work together, we can hopefully build a support system around folks. And we found a remarkable number of companies that will actually give people chances. We built a relationship with a large bank in Minneapolis at one point where we had inmates actually going to work in banking, which is unheard of. But they took the risk knowing. It's when they don't know and they find out afterwards that it tends to limit your access and limit your ability to move forward.
Now, you work for a private agency, a private
Correct.
Company, and I can imagine that this kind of conversation would really give an employer at least a second thought, would at least would begin to consider this mm-hmm. as you lay it out just as you have. For those people who are not going to be hooked up with R.S. Eden, for those other inmates that are getting out and have just the Department of Corrections to rely on, Mark, do you provide something like that for inmates?
We, first of all, it's important to realize that there are 123,000 people on supervision in Minnesota at any given time. All 123,000 have a probation parole officer to do some of the things that Dan's talking about. Obviously, when you get the services that Dan's agency has, you get a much more extensive level of service, a much more comprehensive level of service. But we have 1,200 agents in Minnesota who are very professional, who are highly skilled, highly trained, who are there to help the offender find a job, to find a home, to get a good support system in place. It's incumbent upon that probation officer and the offender to work together to make those things happen.
We talk about a loss of anonymity and people know you and your records follow you. I was flabbergasted to go on the internet and with the last name of one of these gentlemen, be able to pull up everything about him, including a very large color photo. How long has that been possible in the state of Minnesota?
Rachel, and on July 1st of 1999, we started our website. And since that time, less than a year, we had 181,000 hits on that website. So a significant...
Meaning besides me, there were 181,000 people that took the time to look up somebody.
That's correct. Now, we have every reason to believe that a lot of those hits are law enforcement, county attorneys, et cetera, looking for information for whatever purposes they're engaged in. But clearly the public is part of that 181,000. And that gets to my first point, that the public does have a right to know. They're asking for information, and we feel obligated to make sure that they have basic public information.
I use it. Part of my program is to go inside the institutions and meet with men who are in transition programs there, who are getting ready to be released and who want some resources. And I help them find jobs, and I help them find lots of things that they need. And they move around within the system. And so I use it to locate them to find out which institution they happen to be in. So, yes, I do use it, too. It's a very handy tool for me.
We go to Rachel now, who is on the phone in Minneapolis. Good afternoon. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for taking my call, and thanks for this important topic. I think most people recognize that successfully reintegrating criminals into society is important. We all win if they leave a life of crime and become productive citizens. However, I think that there's an undue amount of empathy provided to the reintegration process and the trials and tribulations of these criminals. I'd like to get back to the you were earlier talking about fear. I think fearing somebody because we know their criminal history, because we know the acts they've committed, is not only normal and right, but I think it's healthy. Gavin DeBecker wrote a book called The Gift of Fear, and the premise of that is we need to listen to our instincts. We need to listen to fear because it ultimately protects us. We know that these people have a propensity for violence and illegal activity regardless of the needs and rights of other human beings. So if I fear them, it's not because of the unknown, but precisely because of the known, and I think that that's correct, and I think that that's right.
Comments about that?
Well, I think that we have a tendency to paint all offenders with the most egregious brush that we have. And when the caller makes reference to the fact that people have a propensity for violence, a very small number of offenders have a propensity for violence. Most people are here for property crimes and drug crimes. But yet we tend to look at the most serious and try and envision that as the norm. I would even go so far as to argue that with the emphasis on sex offenders, now we tend to view inmates through the eyes or through glasses as though everyone is as serious as a sex offender. And that's not the case. And I think that we as a society have a tendency to paint that picture, and we do both the inmates and ourselves a disservice with that.
We have Dave on the phone with us from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Stillwater, where he's an inmate. Good afternoon, Dave. Welcome to Main Street.
Hello. First, I want to say that I really, really agree with what's been said on all accounts. I think that our corrections facilities have, if it wasn't for the year that I spent behind bars in 1993 and 94, I would have never been able to change my life. However, I got out in 1996 and proceeded to get a degree. I went to college. And in the last 4 years, I've built up to a position where I make about $60,000 a year. I transferred to Ferrari of Denver as an automotive technician. And I was unfortunate enough to have a minor rule violation. I am a sex offender, considered a sex offender. It was a statutory situation. Where the girl had lied about her age, and it was consensual. And when I got out, the various rules and laws were not in place, so I was able to reenter the community with a certain amount of anonymity, and did very well. I had a encounter with a niece of mine. She was in the house where I was living for about 5 or 10 minutes. And I was revoked, and the state of Minnesota spent approximately $15,000 to transport me back here, flying two people out there to come and get me, a rental car, and they went skiing, and then
Mark, I was... Mark, these sort of violations very seriously, I'm assuming, at the Department of Corrections.
Absolutely, yes. And they made that very clear.
Mr. Carey, go ahead and respond to that, if you would.
Well, we do that. We are very, very careful, particularly around personal crimes. We're very cautious. We don't want another offense. And so we have certain danger signals that when they begin to pop up, it's really our responsibility to intervene extremely quickly, find out what the circumstances are, and if necessary, shore up the circumstance to avoid any further deterioration. Now, obviously, I don't know what was the circumstance in this particular case, but our responsibility is really to provide some tight surveillance and to make sure that that offender does not deteriorate to the point where at some point they're behind bars having committed another offense and saying, why didn't somebody do something earlier?
Our next caller is from southern Minnesota. Good afternoon. Welcome to Main Street.
Hello.
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
I am an ex-offender, and I have been out in the community for approximately 10 years, and I have discovered that when I apply for a job, and I have one of the things that I did after my offense was to go and get my bachelor's degree, and then I went and got my master's degree, and then I continue to work constantly on my ability to cope with this, my history and the things in society and my reactions to them. But I found that if I am straight on a job application, two things will happen to me. Either I will either get no interview at all and no call, or, you know, thanks but no thanks, or I'll get an interview and then they'll put me on trial for their own little court. So what the federal people do the federal officials from the parole department, or I can't remember exactly what it's called, they'll just tell you to leave the thing blank, leave the question blank on the form and respond to it if they ever ask you about it. And so that's what I've done. And I have been able to get some full-time work. But basically, I I seek out temporary work, and because of that, now I will have no retirement or ability to provide for myself should I need to leave the workforce before before my natural working life would end.
Donna Waltring, let me ask you about this to respond to this caller. Is there a sense, being an ex-convict, that you owe everybody an explanation of everything, or do people not have the right to say, that's my past, this is the bare bones of it? Do we have to continue going over it and over it and over it, or should ex-offenders just plan on that?
That, I think, is a difficult question. I caution them when I talk to them about making application to jobs to not necessarily go into the huge, big story, answer the questions, eye-to-eye contact, be efficient with your answer, and then stop and then wait for the next question. I think there are some, I'm sure, there are some employers that have rules or they have insurance that is invaded if they, you know, if they hire an ex-offender, they're not able to do so. But I do know, because through job fairs that Amicus and another organization called Excel in St. Paul have put on, that there are many, many employers who are willing to give that ex-offender a second chance. But it does take looking. It's not like the rest of us that have not committed a crime. It does take search. And I can understand rejection is hard. Many ex-offenders feel like they have ex-con written on their foreheads, and I understand that it's difficult, very difficult.
I would defend this process to some degree. I think as a business owner, I would have a right and a responsibility to know whether the person I'm about to hire behind the cash register is an embezzler or has a history. So I think, again, the word is balance. We need to balance between what the offenders need and what the business owners in this case need.
Dan Cain, Donna Waltring, and Mark Carey, thank you for being with us today. The special Main Street Radio broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineers are Cliff Bentley and Alan Strickland in Rush City and Randy Johnson in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer, site producer Leif Enger, executive producer Mel Summer. We'd like to thank Warden Bert Mose and his staff for making this broadcast from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Rush City possible. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to npr.org and click on Main Street. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. The address again, npr.org. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street team consists of 12 reporters at NPR bureaus across Minnesota. I'm Rachel Reby.
Coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. It's 60 degrees at KNOW FM, 91.1 Minneapolis, St. Paul. Twin Cities weather for today calls for mostly sunny skies, a high of 68 degrees. Tonight, temperatures dropping into the low 40s under clear skies. And for Saturday, sunny skies and warmer with a high near 70 degrees. The time, 1 o'clock.
From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For a number of years, health agencies, and probably your doctor,